Congressman Joe Donnelly, whose district includes many automotive communities, including Kokomo, South Bend, Elkhart. I promised him I would not ask about the Blue Gold game, but I may before the day is over. And next to him is Brian McGowan, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Development in the Department of Commerce. And it might be fair to say that he is now the nation's number one economic development professional. We're very pleased that one of our own has come to this lofty heights. Brian, thank you for joining the panel. And next to him is a fellow Robert Baugh, who is the executive director of the Industrial Union Council of the AFL-CIO. For the last 17 years, he's been helping to guide organized labor in policy discussions on the manufacturing sector, highly relevant to this discussion. And next to him is Tom Brewer, who is running a very, very interesting program called the South Central Tennessee Workforce Alliance that we hope to hear a little bit about before today is over, and he has a lot to contribute. We think about the Great Lakes and the Rust Belt, as folks euphemistically call it, but there are many other parts of the country that are affected by this phenomenon of economic transition, and it's important that we hear from places like Tennessee in this discussion today. And next to him is Dr. Jay Noreen, who is the president of Wayne State University. This is a wall-to-wall Detroit day, obviously. The importance of the auto industry can't help but talking about Detroit at every facet and at every turn of our discussion. We're really lucky that such a central institution to discussing automotive communities and their rebound to the new economy is with us today. And next to him is our first presenter, Brad Whitehead, who is the president of the Fund for Our Economic Future, an important collaborative of philanthropy, universities, hospitals, chambers of commerce, and industry in Northeast Ohio. We'll hear more about that from Brad in a moment. And he is followed last but not least by Dr. Scott Hutchison, who is with the Purdue Center for Regional Development, who also is going to be one of our important presenters today and will hopefully stimulate lots of discussion from our panelists in the audience. Before I introduce the first presenter, I just want to make one brief comment. Today is a very, very important day for those of us in organized philanthropy who have been working to raise up local partners or who have wanted to talk about national investments that the philanthropic sector has made to revitalizing automotive communities. And while I don't have an announcement like Luis Urbina's $200 million five-year announcement today, I want to tell a story. In some ways, this is like a harvesting day for me. About 11 years ago, Bruce Katz from the Brookings Institution and his newly appointed assistant, Amy Liu, both of them were new to Brookings at the time, came through Cleveland and came to my office to discuss the prospect of some grant support. And we had probably about a half an hour conversation, and I knew very quickly that Bruce got it and that he would, by taking a grant from the Gund Foundation, do so much to raise the status and the conversation of our local grantees and allow us also to have access to a national conversation in ways that I couldn't fathom being matched in any other way. And we've been at it a long time, but in iteration after iteration, conversation after conversation, we've come to the point where a lot of local practitioners, a number of affected states, and a very interested national administration are coming together to discuss frames that cohere on a lot of levels. It's a very significant event today, even if we don't come away with any bigger announcements than what we've already heard. We're making relationships, we're learning new ideas, we're really, really in an important state that is a part of a long journey. But I think it's very much a relationship that has paid off handsomely for us and hopefully will continue to pay dividends in the future. One of the local groups that we have asked Bruce to raise up into the national conversation is the Fund for Our Economic Future. And the presentation, the first presentation is from the president of the Fund for Economic Future, Brad Whitehead. Brad, I could go on and give you a great flowery introduction, but I think you can say... And then Brad will give a flowery introduction of Scott Hutchison when he concludes. Brad, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And when I first moved to Cleveland, I was in my 20s, and so I didn't have a lot of money, but I was excited about the Cleveland Indians, and I got season tickets. And I don't know if any of you have been or have heard of the old Cleveland Municipal Stadium, but the view from my seats in Cleveland was a lot like the view of those people around the corner there. So if something's going on in right field, I'll be sure to let you know. It is a real pleasure and a privilege to be here today. I am feeling a little bit of Detroit envy with hearing all of the exciting things going on in Southeast Michigan as they meet their challenge. My goal today is to take a few moments to share with you some of the experiences and lessons that we've learned in Northeast Ohio as our region has come together to reverse decades of economic stagnation. And while that situation is severe, we know that our circumstances are not unique. And so hopefully there are some lessons for your geographies as well in the progress. And while we don't feel like we have the answer, we do feel like we've made some progress in mounting a coordinated response. And so this afternoon, what I look forward to doing is sharing with you some of the connections that we've had between the foundation community, many other sectors of the Northeast Ohio economy, and the federal government to attempt to transform the challenged economy of Northeast Ohio. And my hope really is twofold. One is I hope that some of our efforts will be relevant to you in your efforts in your communities. But second is I feel like I'm on a bit of a sales call as well, because I hope that the successes that we've had in Northeast Ohio will encourage our federal partners to take this emerging model that we're developing here and bring it to the next level. Now, I was told that I might have an ability to trigger this PowerPoint automatically. Do I just need to... What's that? So I'll just nod and say I'm ready for the next one. So my name is Brad Whitehead, and as Bob mentioned, I'm president of the Fund for Our Economic Future. What the fund is a collaboration of some 100 philanthropic entities committed to strengthening the competitiveness of our 16-county region in Northeast Ohio, and that includes Cleveland, Akron, Youngstown, and Canton. So I'm here today representing that philanthropic collaboration and the important role that we think philanthropy can play in a turnaround. But I'm also here representing a broader coalition of shareholders from throughout the region that includes not only the fund, but also leaders from the public sector, the private sector, and the civic sectors. And we are currently engaged in a multi-county transformation program. It's called Advance Northeast Ohio. This Advance Northeast Ohio plan was launched in 2007 after some rather extensive public engagement, economic analysis, and deliberation among much of the regional leadership in Northeast Ohio. So I wanted, that's us, and now the next one. Let's make no mistake about it. The situation is a challenging one in our part of the world, and it has been for some time. Now, I'm a recovering business consultant, and so the temptation I have is to share with you dozens of statistics and charts to illustrate the very complex economic challenges that face the 4 million citizens who call Northeast Ohio home. However, today I'll just share one. And as this chart shows, while the rest of the country was creating jobs before the Great Recession, Northeast Ohio was losing jobs. And so breaking that cycle of job loss is the key to our region's economic future. And while the rather dramatic challenges of the last 2 years of this Great Recession precipitated this conference and today's program, I think it is important for us to note, as speakers have this morning, that the economic challenges facing Northeast Ohio are really many, many years in the making. Indeed, the economic data that I've seen suggests that the high water mark for our economy was sometime in the early 1950s. And I think it's important to hold this in mind, just the magnitude of this challenge. In the Midwest, there's this common saying, perhaps you use it in your communities, that we're facing our own economic Katrina. Thank you. Okay, got it. Thank you. We're facing our own economic Katrina. But in our case, this is an economic hurricane that's unfolded over decades. I use that analogy with no disrespect to the great people of Louisiana and Mississippi, but rather to illustrate the scale of change that we must achieve. After Hurricane Katrina devastated the New Orleans area, it required the marshaling of resources on a scale and across sectors that few of us had ever seen. There were more than 15 million people affected by Katrina and more than 400,000 jobs lost. Importantly, on a conservative basis, more than $100 billion was spent on the recovery efforts, and that is nearly half of Louisiana's annual GDP. But it was just this type of alignment across all levels of government and on a scale to succeed, which is the reason residents are now returning to Louisiana, businesses are growing, and the world is again seeing the New Orleans that it loves, and hopefully that will continue as the oil hits the beach. So today the president is in Youngstown, Ohio. And if we look at recent experiences in Youngstown, it's no wonder he's there. We're talking about auto communities. In addition to the highly publicized layoffs at Delphi Automotive, which one of the questioners asked about this morning, where 6,000 jobs have been lost, that ripple effect extends to scores of mid-sized companies serving the auto and steel sectors that collectively and cumulatively total thousands and thousands of additional job losses. And that's just in one part of our region. So I think it's important, and this has been emphasized through the morning, to make no mistake about it. This is a transformation that we're talking about, a transformation. Think post-war reconstruction. Think moon landing. If this is our economic Katrina, so to speak, we need to marshal a response that's commensurate to that challenge. And it's a response that's not about bailouts. It's a response that's about smarter investments. We must align, and we must scale the available resources we have and make sure that no players are left on the bench. Now, the good news for us in Northeast Ohio, and hopefully in your community, but the good news for us is that we have the ability to cure what ails us. We know what we have to do, and we know the magnitude of the challenge. We are focused on increasing jobs, increasing incomes, and decreasing concentrated poverty. Now, ultimately, our aspiration is to be a leader in the nation, but over the next 10 years, our goal is to get to national averages. But we're talking about systemic transformation, not, as one of the speakers said this morning, tinkering around the edges. Tinkering would not have built New Orleans, and tinkering won't rebuild the industrial Midwest. There is no silver bullet approach to the region's economy. Rather, as one of my colleagues and friends like to say, what we need is silver buckshot. Now, Northeast Ohio, through its Advanced Northeast Ohio Plan, is aiming our silver buckshot at four broad priorities: business growth, human capital development, inclusion, and government collaboration. We are using a collaborative, integrated approach designed to build the locally distinctive assets of our region. So let's unpack that. Regional. In our community, that's at least five different metropolitan areas that need to work together, each of which has its own identity, but sharing capital markets, supply chains, and labor pools. It's integrated because we know that you can't solve a business growth issue without aligning human capital and transportation and the like. And while our heritage has a rich heritage, and while our region has a rich heritage of individual action, we know that we must be collaborative because the challenge is so far beyond the reach of any one sector or institution. Now, all of that sounds painfully, painfully logical and simple, but we have found that it is one thing to say the words regional, integrated, and collaborative, but it's quite another to pull it off when history, legal constructs and frameworks and other industries and other incentives seem to be pulling us constantly in the opposite direction. Now, the model of change on which we have landed, and frankly, we've landed on it largely through trial and error, is neither fully top-down nor bottom-up. Instead, we're working simultaneously on systems change in policy, structures, and incentives at the top. But this, then, is informed by practical experience working with very specific portfolios of companies and individual initiatives. We found that if we only focus on the systems, we're going to get lots and lots and lots of planning and no action. But if we only focus on transactions, we'll get all kinds of little victories that'll look good in the newspaper, but after 5 or 10 years, it doesn't add up to a transformation. And this change, the system and portfolio change, is supported by an aligned network of partners from the private and public sectors, philanthropic and civic communities, business, labor, colleges, the universities, and more. So you may be wondering why philanthropy, and a number of our colleagues have talked about it this morning. Why should we be tackling economic development? First, and I hope foremost, is we believe that philanthropy brings limited self-interest. We don't have elections to win, we don't have shareholders to satisfy, or personal stock options to vest. Second, money matters, and we can bring risk capital to the job. We are able to provide the ugly, flexible first dollars in, or like we like to say, we can be like the Marines. Our dollars are often the first ones on the beach. Thirdly, philanthropy brings a level of stability and constancy to all those that are involved. In a world of increasing transience, foundations are enduring institutions that aren't going anywhere. As such, we are able to take the long view. And then finally, we are able to convene our region and on our good days, maybe even hold it together. So how does all that play out in practice? Well, let's look at the case of entrepreneurship, which has been a big theme of this morning. 5 years ago, the best piece of advice you could have given to an entrepreneur in Northeast Ohio was to leave. In fact, our region that was once home to such industry and business pioneers as Marcus Hanna, B.F. Goodrich, J.O. Eaton, John D. Rockefeller was quiet. It was dead quiet. In fact, Entrepreneur Magazine had ranked our community 61st out of 61 communities in entrepreneurship. Breaking that cycle, however, took an intentional effort, a concerted, integrated approach that involved dozens, if not hundreds of partners, all focused on translating great ideas that were still emerging from our region and turning them into high-growth companies. In effect, reviving entrepreneurship became a civic priority in which many key players oriented themselves, and we think we've made headway. In fact, key regional and state players got behind this effort. State government policies were changed, and new government programs were put into place to strengthen the region's innovation infrastructure and attract more capital. And indeed, the recent renewal of the Ohio Third Frontier Initiative speaks to the tremendous impact that has been occurring. Programs were put in place to train and attract entrepreneurial talent. Specific programs were developed to make sure the region's minority residents participated in this resurgent and that it resulted in investment in our urban core. The federal government, with its EDA funding and other programs, was also a major factor. At the same time, philanthropy and the organized business community invested millions of dollars into high-octane intermediaries such as Jumpstart to attract capital to the region and to support promising entrepreneurs. And our universities, research institutions, and even community colleges strengthened their commercialization functions and created innovation funds. But most importantly, entrepreneurs, angel investors, and venture capitalists answered the call by starting companies and creating and expanding pools of risk capital. So the result today is that we have a portfolio of hundreds of promising companies, many of which didn't even exist 5 or 10 years ago. We've broken the cycle of decline in entrepreneurship and have now started a virtuous cycle of entrepreneurial activity, when sustained over an extended period, will help transform the region's economy. So the question is, what's next? Manufacturing and human capital development are our priorities. I will only touch for just a moment on manufacturing, and I'm hopeful in the question and answer we might discuss workforce, as we have now an exciting new partnership with the Cerdna and Joyce Foundations. But despite the cataclysm that is the traditional automotive supply chain, Northeast Ohio still retains a strong manufacturing base with a skilled workforce. We do know how to make things in Northeast Ohio. And the opportunity we have is to build from that base with the same sort of integrated, collaborative approach that the region brought to entrepreneurship and with a focus on growth by design. I very much liked Governor Granholm's comment that this is not about being post-industrial, it is about stage three manufacturing. Northeast Ohio has thousands of middle market manufacturers. And the question becomes, can all of them make the transition from old growth industries into higher growth industries? And sadly enough, we think the answer is no. But the question is, can 20 or 25% of our high potential ones make the bridge? We think the answer is yes. The key to doing this, though, will be to support them with the appropriate alignment of resources. There is no one thing to get this right. This is extraordinarily challenging work for a middle market company. We're talking about market identification, product innovation, export-led development, innovation financing, workforce retraining, supply chain repositioning, and the like. And this set of skills, while they can be coordinated by a single intermediary, in our case, it's by an entity called Magnet, Manufacturing Advocacy and Growth Network, must involve a broad network of players, including public and private entities who know the end-use markets, who can develop talent and put risk capital to work. Importantly, the manufacturing extension partnerships understand this model, the EDA understands this model, the Labor Department understands it, the SBA understands it, so does the Ohio Department of Development, our 16 counties, and our many community colleges. And local philanthropy in Ohio understands it as well. This is a very complicated proposition, but we must and can put the resources together in new ways and bring the ideas to ground. So what have we learned so far? And I'll wrap it up and turn it over to Scott. First, we've learned that this can be done. It can actually happen. We've learned that we can and must work regionally, collaboratively, and in an integrated manner, and that philanthropy can play one important role in the change, and that whatever we do, it must be done at scale. As I said earlier, this can't be tinkering around the edges. So how do we come together? We believe local philanthropy is here and is here to stay and is ready to be the boots on the ground to make sure that what we say we are going to do gets done. Now, we're ready to get going now. As a 20-year consultant, I found that the best planning in conditions of change and uncertainty is accomplished by getting moving and to learn to do by doing. We're ready to do that. We're ready to do it together, and we're ready to do it right now. Thank you very much. So one of the leading lights in a lot of the work we've been doing has been emanating out of Purdue University and the work in Central Indiana. So it's an especial pleasure for me to introduce Scott Hutchison, who has been leading the charge in a lot of that work.
Okay, I'd like to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon to talk about what we've learned in Indiana over the last few years about regional innovation. In 2005, our Purdue Center for Regional Development was asked to help a group of strong local leaders from mostly rural communities in our region to figure out how they could work together across municipal boundaries to transform the regional economy. Slowly at first, and then later with really amazing speed, we began to see some remarkable innovations occur. And when the recession hit us, we had already figured out how to function as a high-performing regional civic network that could quickly identify innovative solutions and then link and leverage our regional assets to launch effective strategies. The hub of our regional network remains Purdue University, with additional members at the core like other colleges and universities, K-12, our local economic development organizations, SBDC, our workforce board, tech parks, incubators, along with our state and federal partners like EDA, DOL, NIST, and philanthropic partners like our local community foundations, the Kauffman Foundation, and others. Now, most of our responses to the economic crisis seamlessly integrated the perspectives and resources of workforce development, economic development, and business development, helping both individuals and firms re-engage with the restructuring economy. This notion of economic re-engagement was just one of the innovative approaches we developed. We recognized that in a restructuring regional economy, where both workers and firms were finding themselves disengaged, there were multiple pathways for them to re-engage with that shifting economy. And there's a different set of resources and needs that need to be aligned to move them through each of these pathways. I'm going to stop now and show you part of a video we produced that illustrates just one of these re-engagement pathways. So we can start the video.
I spent 29 years, a couple of months, in the automotive industry, electronics, electronic design.
I had assumed that I might be able to retire from a company I'd worked 25 years for.
Late last fall, due to the shrink in the automotive industry and all that, I basically don't work there anymore.
This community, unfortunately, has been a real downturn economically with the automotive industry, and it's hit very hard. I've lost a lot of good friends.
Kokomo is, you know, obviously the, you know, one of the centers of the auto industry, especially in Indiana. And at one time we had, you know, probably 15,000 auto workers, and now we maybe have five.
I believe it was in September of 08 now that there was a headline that came out in our local newspaper that talked about 600 engineering jobs that would be shed from Delphi Electronics. That was a very much a wake-up call for us.
These folks called this area home. They didn't want to leave here. They had knowledge and expertise that is just unbelievable in scale, yet they really didn't have much employment to turn to. There weren't that many other viable alternatives locally.
To lose 600 engineering jobs from this community, the economic impact that would have going forward, just in terms of, you know, schools, your tax base, it just snowballs into a lot of different areas. We really saw that as a challenge economically for this community. So we started thinking of ways that we could, you know, retain some of that talent in this community. We felt very strongly about was pulling this group of people together into a engineering services firm. And so there was a firm that we have put together. It's called New Path,
which basically allows these engineers to stay here, earn a living here, and without that, a lot of those people would be gone, would have to leave Kokomo.
One of the other initiatives that the Department of Labor funding is paying for is a fully functional public community-based CAD lab.
Because of the talent base that we have here and the innovative minds that we know that we have, we thought that there would be some that may have some entrepreneurial interest and some ideas for some new ventures.
The partners and I were working at Delphi in the automotive electronics industry and kind of came together over a common interest.
We started thinking about what's going to be something else to do that might be worthwhile.
We saw friends losing their jobs and we just decided what could we do in case that happened to us, and this was an idea we'd wrestled with for a while anyway.
I also have had some software ideas that came about really through the lunchtime discussion in the tech workplace.
A lot of these people are brilliant, very creative, they've got ideas on their own and have never stepped forward as far as trying to establish their own business.
We put together a proposal. At that time, there was some dollars that were available through the Department of Labor. When it came to my turn to pitch our idea, people really immediately supported the idea. It was really a pretty astounding moment, you know, when you have other people around the table who have projects that they want funded and suddenly they put them aside because they see the value in the proposal that we had pitched. That day, I mean, we walked out of that room with some seed funding at $35,000 to get started while the proposal was fully vetted, and then eventually it was fully funded at about $400,000.
From a technical background, it's not a God-given gift to be able to run a business.
I know the chemistry background, what I can do, my technical ability, but as far as the business aspect, that's very much an unknown entity for me.
The individuals many times knew their widget, they knew their technology or their service, but they really didn't understand the business side, what it took to bring that to fruition.
There are a lot of perceived risk when it comes to starting their own business. We really needed to, number one, bring in some resources to help reduce those perceived risks for those folks. We put them through Fast Track Launchpad training. This is a collaborative effort between the Kauffman Foundation and the Deluxe Corporation Foundation.
Fast Track Tech Venture is a very logical, analytical approach to getting a business created.
In a matter of about 6 weeks, they understood the concept of their business, and now they have a product that they can deliver to describe and then take to the market rather quickly after that.
The course was phenomenal. And it was far more deep and far wider than I expected it to be. It was very involved. There was a lot of work.
A lot of the tools that were presented and the knowledge and how to interweave them and integrate all those skill sets together was very helpful.
There are legal issues, HR issues, just financial capital issues, in addition to protection of the intellectual property. I know I learned a lot along those lines.
But everything comes together, all of the hard work, all of the effort culminates in investor presentations. Basically, we brought in four of the local banks. We brought in the angel investment.
Now, the rest of that story is available on YouTube if you want to see how it ends. And see me and I'll provide a link to it for you. But the story goes on to describe the impact thus far with several new businesses being started and dozens of new jobs being created. Now, that's just one of about 60 different stories I could tell you today. Over the course of the last 4 years, we've launched over 60 initiatives, all focused around four strategic objectives, and some of our metrics include the training of over 25,000 individuals, over 3,600 unemployed workers placed in jobs within our target industries, nearly 2,000 degrees and certifications awarded, many of which are new programs we developed, like a nanostructured coatings technology certificate and a green manufacturing certificate. We've seen $2.1 million in industry cost savings from energy efficiency programs, 18 new products launched, and $1.7 million in top-line sales growth by existing businesses, and 10 new businesses created. And over 80% of those initiatives that we launched are continuing on today, even after initial investment is over. So now we get a chance to go all over the country and teach other regions how to create these new civic networks that can launch and sustain innovative strategies and programs. And we have five principles that we think are key when doing this sort of regional transformation work. Number one, you can't really wait for a crisis to engage in the practice of region building. Number two, you have to go slow before you can go fast. Number three, strategic doing is just as important as strategic planning, probably even more so. Number four, throw out the org chart and replace it with a network map. Number five, focus on assets rather than deficits. Now, I was also asked today to provide my opinion on how the federal and philanthropic partners here today could best assist in this transformation of our auto communities. So I'll leave you with four pieces of advice for them. Number one, focus federal and philanthropic policies, programs, and resources toward promoting regional civic innovation networks, like the one we just talked about. Look to hub organizations, like universities, that can span election cycles to help build these regional networks. Create a strong platform to collaborate across regions to learn what works so that Kokomo can learn from Youngstown and Youngstown can learn from Detroit. And then lastly, provide some seed financing to launch these promising initiatives. I'll turn it back over to you. Thank you very much.
Scott and Brad, thank you both very, very much.
I wonder how these videos and presentations stimulate our panelists' thinking from their perspective, from their places, their institutions. Congressman, maybe what I'll do is start with you. Maybe you can try to put yourselves in the shoes of a colleague from another district, say Marsha Fudge from the Cleveland area, or Tim Ryan, who is from Youngstown. How does a local constituency trying to advance this agenda approach their congressperson and build constituencies within the region's delegation?
The easiest way is just to start the relationship. When, you know, we're home every weekend. So Marcia and Tim are available at most any time. Just give them a call, sit down, and say, we need to talk about how do we create our future, how do we move this forward. And all day Friday, all day Saturday, we have appointments all day unless there's a parade or something like that. And so our job, if you talk about jobs, we're all over it. So the idea that maybe your congressperson is not accessible, I don't think you'd find that. I think you'd find them more than eager to sit down, to talk about whatever idea you have, and how do we work together. I am blessed to represent the Kokomo area that the professor was talking about. And I actually had one of my town halls last August in the parking lot of Inventrek Technology Park. And we had approximately 600 people in the parking lot there. And it's an extraordinary facility. There's a number of new companies coming along there, and it was the technology and intelligence of Delphi that has gone over there. But for you, all I do is call, because I guarantee you they'll sit down. And my primary job, or one of my primary jobs, is to create more jobs, to make sure that we're being a good partner. I know there's some folks from the auto companies here. We were looking right at the abyss last year. And at this point, I don't know in Kokomo that we've had a stronger future in decades than what we look at now. Think of this: in the last month there, Chrysler announced that they're going to be investing almost $300 million in the transmission plants. They added 400 new jobs at the transmission plants. Delphi, through the Recovery Act, it just opened up a new plant where they'll be doing electric vehicle components at. And I know General Motors in Fort Wayne just added approximately 1,400 additional jobs, or is in the process of doing that. So this partnership, and I think the key is to be really honest with each other too, because, you know, one of the conversations I had, I'll try to wrap this up, with some of the workers, the workers were extraordinary. They understood exactly what had to happen. But I had one of the fellows come up and say, you know, I'd rather have my old job at the wages I was making then. And I said, well, you can certainly have that. I said, nobody will hire you, but, you know, you can certainly hang your shingle out promoting that. We have to be the most competitive, the most advanced, and understand that. And the companies are stepping up, because their job is, give us the very, very best product designs. We'll make the very best product, and together we can grow this thing, I think.
Thank you very much. Dr. Noreen, I'm curious about how you take your experience at Wayne State and put the kind of role that you play in Detroit into context with the Fund for Economic Future in Northeast Ohio, or the role you play that may be similar or different to what's happened at Purdue in the Kokomo Initiative.
What I was saying is there are a number of similarities and some significant differences. The similarities have to do a lot with entrepreneurship. We are heavily involved in entrepreneurial training programs like Fast Track and others. What difference? There may be some difference in that there's a size difference, but there is also a difference in the need, in our case, to build out space, to create space for entrepreneurial training. So we have invested about $20 million in space to bring people to a central location in near the campus for entrepreneurial training, Fast Track and beyond. We have another program we call Smart Start, which goes, Fast Track is fairly targeted and relatively short. Smart Start goes as long as 2 years, and it goes to the next stage of entrepreneurial development, but very similar in character to what Scott described. So that's one strong similarity. A difference is that we've now connected, in the last couple of years, our entrepreneurial programs with our more formal graduate and undergraduate programs both in engineering and in medicine, because we have a large biomedical activity. So we have a biomedical engineering program that's new. We have an alternative energy technology program, both the master's and the bachelor's level. And we have other kinds of programs that are related to bringing automotive engineers in to redirect their focus. So this fall, for example, we had 50 automotive engineers come in for a special non-traditional approach to a master's degree in alternative hybrid vehicle engineering, and then the same thing in the winter. So we've begun to connect our entrepreneurial programs with our more formal graduate programs. The area that I think is probably at least a little bit different is a third area of emphasis, and that's the connection of the university to the revitalization of the community. We live right in the middle of what's called the Woodward Corridor, from downtown to the area of the cultural institutions, and there are three anchors: a large medical center, the university, and a second large medical center with a total of 28,000 employees and $4.5 billion in annual operating expenditures. These institutions, now just recently with funding from foundations, are beginning to connect to the community for revitalization in terms of public safety. We have a police department. The two other health center anchors have security systems. We put them together. We each have separate shuttle systems. We've joined the shuttle system. So now there's a shuttle service that goes all the way up and down the Woodward Corridor in preparation for light rail, which will be coming in about 18 months. And in Detroit, light rail is a pretty impressively new thing, especially in the Woodward Corridor. We're connecting in terms of our students on the campus becoming part-time employees for the two medical centers. They're always looking for part-time employees, and they would like part-time employees that have already been vetted. Small businesses in the community, a community which has not had much small business, now we are helping to develop the small business. So the difference probably is we have a very large investment with foundation support in revitalizing the neighborhood. And then finally, and probably the most challenging, is revitalizing the K-12 schools, which are probably in the worst shape in Detroit of any place in the country. We have about 120 programs where we work collaboratively with the K-12 schools, and our interest is in working with foundations and others to revitalize the schools, because bringing a workforce into the community requires that kind of support and that kind of quality of life. So that connection goes beyond entrepreneurship and education. It's really an essential part of revitalizing the community.
Thanks, Dr. Noreen. As we all know from the bios, Tom Brewer runs an important workforce retraining program in a Saturn plant that was located in Tennessee a number of years ago with a lot of fanfare. Tom, I'm wondering if you could share with us, I think as we've discussed, the secret sauce of your program and why it's so successful. And after that, can you like put it into the context of the civic structure, much like the fund? Or, in the alternative, is there an academic center that kind of helps to give you grist for the mill in the work that you do, much like Purdue does in Kokomo? Okay,
sure.
I think it's like a four-part question.
Little background first. First of all, I'm proud to represent Tennessee today. Most people really don't think of Tennessee as being an automotive state. We actually have three OEM assembly plants and an engine plant. Nissan, of course, is in Smyrna. We have the new Volkswagen plant that's just about ready to come online in Chattanooga. And then, of course, as Bob talked about, this old Saturn plant, the General Motors assembly plant in Spring Hill. And I spent 25 years at that plant, so we're very familiar with that. But we came here to talk about automotive communities today. So let me just tell you real quick, I have lived in an automotive community literally all my life. I grew up in Bedford, Indiana. And my father and almost every father worked at the General Motors plant. Went to Saginaw, Michigan, and started my career for General Motors up there, and saw the real negative side. I had responsibility to close a foundry in Saginaw, Michigan, and then another one in Tonawanda. So I saw the effects of closures of plants early in my career. Then went to Beijing, China, built a plant over there, or was just actually in the process of building a plant in Beijing, and got the call, hey, would you like to go to Spring Hill, Tennessee, and build this thing that most people didn't even know what it was at the time, But so I came, in quite a cultural shock, you can imagine, going from Beijing to a small rural town in Spring Hill, Tennessee. But we built a corporation, a new corporation, we built a new car, we built a new culture, and then literally built a new automotive community in Spring Hill. So that, again, going from closing plants to probably building at the time, the largest industrial project in North America. So over 50 years, I've seen an awful lot. I've lived it all my life. So these last 2 years, you go, wow. I mean, it has been a roller coaster. And most, it's mostly been downhill, certainly on that. But so every one of you guys, whether you're a community or state, you know, you've had that question, will General Motors, will Chrysler, will the suppliers make it? Will they go bankrupt? And then in particular, will our city, will our plant, will they make it? Will they be closed? And then on top of that, then the next thing, which I had to personally go through too, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to the workers? Do they quit? Do they retire? Do they move away because they transferred? So in June of 2009, you know, as General Motors started to go through bankruptcy, and that was just a year ago, you can imagine the turmoil we were all going through, and certainly at a General Motors plant going through the turmoil. Just a year ago, it was announced that the Spring Hill assembly plant would go in standby. Well, what in the world does standby mean? But what it really meant was it wasn't closed, it wasn't the knife to the heart that would never open again, but it was put in standby. So that put 2,000 General Motors employees and then 3,000 suppliers, and they became displaced auto workers. We already were in an 8-county location that had the highest unemployment in Tennessee. Prior to this, 5,000 people. One of our counties was right at 27-28% unemployment already. Our Tennessee Career Centers were full. They were overburdened with double-digit inflation or unemployment, and then here's 5,000 more people to put into the pool. What are you going to do? We actually worked with, and again, I was with General Motors at the time. We worked with the state, the governor's office, Economic Development Commission, and then with General Motors, and General Motors was very helpful. And in the old Saturn Executive Office and Training Center, Saturn was a training organization, so we had a lot of training facilities. Hey, let's use that as a transition center. Let's use that as a pseudo career center. So for these people that don't have to go to all the other career centers because they're already full, let's use that and be very specific with that. So that's what we did. We used the Workforce Investment Act group, South Central Tennessee Workforce Alliance, to coordinate all of that and actually utilize their career advisors and actually use the Workforce Investment Act dollars. So all these 5,000 people that were eligible for training that we brought into, it's called Northfield, the building is called Northfield. So as we brought them into Northfield, this was free training to them, put on by, and we collaborated with the local Columbia State University, the Tennessee Technical Centers. Tennessee has 27 technical centers. We brought them in, Middle Tennessee State University, Volunteer State University, Belmont University, to create, you know, we weren't creating a school, we were using this existing great facility to help the community, to help these 5,000 people. So we use that. We use individual career counseling, actually, because in a short period of time, almost 5 months, we've already had 1,100 people go through individual career counseling, and then we took that feedback and created a curriculum. Hey, we went to, again, Belmont and said, can you do a teaching licensure class for us, for people that have 4-year degrees already?
So
can you do this?
Tom, it's interesting. There's this, like the phone call, it's interesting. You're harder to get to the secret sauce than my grandmother with the barbecue recipe.
Okay.
Are there just a couple of things, that lessons that you think you can impart to those of us that are trying to do the kind of work that you do in your locality? What's the secret to the success of your program?
Luckily, we had an early start. I mean, again, announcement of a closure in June of last year, but the closure wasn't until November. So we were able to say, what can we do? How can we prepare these people for when the event happens? It's not going to be, hey, you start from the event, you start from the pre-event. So that's probably the key. Now, are you always going to have that? Certainly not. But that really worked for us.
And you're also on site. Is that another secret?
Yes, on site.
Yes. Very good. Any more secrets to the sauce?
Well, again, just the collaboration of the state and local governments. We really got support, again, from the governor's office, Department of Labor, the Tennessee Department of Labor, Economic and Community Development, our local representatives, county mayor. I mean, everybody's involved. And we meet with them, talk with them, and basically work it out.
Those of us on the Great Lakes are glad that Tennessee is here. Bob Baugh has worked for the last 17 years for the AFL-CIO concentrating on manufacturing, but I know that he's been an economic development professional in Oregon and was raised in two auto communities, Cleveland and Detroit. Based on all that you've heard today, Bob, and the experience that you bring with the AFL-CIO, what kind of insights do you have to the conversation?
Thank you. I think there's a couple things that I heard. I made some notes here while Brad and Scott were talking, and they talked about a couple of things that are really important. You've been talking about the rapid response network and how people coordinate to do that. What Brad and Scott got at is, what is the economic development side of this? How do you operate at scale? How do you integrate your resources? How do you coordinate? How do you think regionally? How do you collaborate as part of the key? And Scott was making the point of, you know, we have this huge skill and technical capacity that has been put out of work. How do we best utilize that? As Senator Stabenow said earlier, we make things. And I think this is the bridge between that panel today and what you're talking about at the local level. And there's a couple things that I think that really matter here. That speak towards what does the federal government have to do that enhances the state and local activity. One, I think you got to do as a Congressman Levin said, you got to have a strategy. You know, in a way, the comments about the regional piece is a regional strategy. We need a national strategy. We got to decide we want to have manufacturing. And then we got to take the steps to make sure that happens. We've stumbled our way there. We stumbled to a decision that we want an auto industry. We passed a Recovery Act that made a down payment on a new energy economy, which everybody has referred to today about how do we train people for green technologies, how do you do this. It's the right thing to do. It's pieces of a strategy as a nation. Now you have to think at scale. We were posed the question in the room a little while ago about $1 billion in Detroit. If you think of it like that, what would you do? What would you do with $4 trillion? Because that's what this nation will invest in the next two decades. We have a $2.2 trillion infrastructure deficit. We have several trillion more that will be invested in a new energy economy. We know we'll build this stuff. We know we'll install this stuff. The question is, will we make it here? And how will we use our public resources and leverage those private resources to make sure we capture the employment opportunity, particularly in the industrial Midwest, where we have this reservoir of out-of-work capacity, not only just infrastructure, I mean buildings, but the knowledge and the skills. Everybody from the skilled production workers to the engineers, the scientists. Let me give you a number that will scare people here. We lost 6 million manufacturing jobs in the last decade. Nearly 1 million of those, 2/3 of those were skilled production workers. But nearly 1 million of those were scientists, engineers, designers, developers, all the other people that are part of the innovative capacity and chain of our nation, right? That's what we're blowing. That's what we're missing. That's what you're trying to recapture at the local level, and that's so important. So I think that leads to a number of decisions we have to begin to make as a country. One, we put Buy America into the Recovery Act, and we're going to fight to put it in every other piece of legislation. But I'll tell you, it's simply tactical. It says you got to try and find American firms that make that stuff. If not, you can get it elsewhere, and you got to honor international agreements. But you got to make the decision. You want to try and buy it here. It's tactical. It's not strategic. It's not industry development. And that's how we have to think on a much more concerted, concentrated level at scale about how do you do that. For example, we're talking about a $50 billion investment in high-speed rail and mass transit in the next Surface Transportation Act. That's a lot of money. You can spread it around, and locally people can hope they can negotiate to have a rail assembly, car assembly plant in their backyard, or we can really think about how we leverage it to get the entire production system in the United States. It's a big question. Over half our money for the Energy Production Tax Credit has gone offshore for wind turbines made in Spain. China tried to just do it. They didn't get it. But it really poses the question, why, if we're going to build a zillion wind turbines in the Great Plains, aren't we building the industry in the Great Lakes? On the wind charts, it's just as blue around the Great Lakes as it is on the Great Plains, and we should build the industry there where the capacity is. We can move stuff by rail, we can bring it up by barge and ship and run it through Duluth when we're ready with a new grid out there. I mean, this is the idea, back to your regional point, of trying to think concentrated, try to think at scale about how we do these things as a nation so that our investments are spent to their maximum efficiency, creating the best jobs here, and that they're leveraged to find the best technology in the world and make it here. We can't assume we have the best anymore, especially when it comes to mass transit or high-speed rail or wind turbines. So that's the kind of thinking that I think really comes with this as a country, of how you think about how you work together and not stumble to a decision out of crisis that we want to have an auto industry, but in fact, we want to have a rail industry, a high-speed rail industry. We want to have a wind turbine industry. These are things we are going to invest in. We have choices to make about how we do that. How do you leverage your public assets to make that happen? For example, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. What a tool for everything you need, right? At the local level, it's a great tool for technical assistance for firms. There's a new role for them. I've been meeting with them for 3 years to think about their role as organizers of the supply chain to help them meet these needs of these new technologies and capture the work here. Those are things we can do together. I would put a third challenge out for states. And then
time is running short, Bob.
This is the last piece. I think it's really important. It's how you struggle to get your regional people to work together and coordinate. I think we have the same problem between our states. I've done this. I've beggared thy neighbor in state economic development. We actually need a coordination and incentives for states to work together around the development of high-speed rail industry and not try to be just beating each other up for the jobs that are in the other state, but how we grow together.
Thank you, Bob. I'm actually a graduate of the same college as Tim Russert, and we obviously didn't have the same teachers or the same skill sets. Can you imagine how tough it must be to do one of those primaries with all those candidates in the early days of just after Iowa? I can't fathom it after this panel. Secretary McGowan, we have not forgotten about you. In some ways, there's been some sort of method to our madness here. In one sense, we started with Congressman Donnelly talking about the interaction of local, regional initiatives with their legislative representatives. I'm wondering if you could, in the same vein, give us a sense of this administration's thinking about how to interact with automotive places and how that results in programmatic initiatives, relationships with the Hill. Can you give us some inside stuff on how things really work here in Washington?
Sure. Between the giant pillar and the lights, I can't see many people, but I know there's a lot of economic developers here in the audience. And I am a local economic developer for all of my career. I've worked at the local, county, and state level. And I know you'll all understand this. We're always happy when government appoints an actual economic developer to do an economic developer's job in government. Doesn't happen often, but happy to be here. I left my job in California not because I was getting paid in IOUs, but because I felt strongly that this administration was on the right track. The messaging that was coming out of the National Economic Council and Brookings and others, I felt was really elevating our profession, economic developers, back up to where it should be. There wasn't that much dialogue at the federal level on that concept of local economic development. So, yeah, our plan really is to reinvent the EDA. Assistant Secretary Fernandez and I have very aggressive plans to bring the EDA into the 21st century. That's not to say that it hasn't done good work in the past. It has, but it's time now to reinvent it and bring it into line with current economic conditions. We're a small agency. I think most people think we're bigger than we are. We have about 190 employees in 6 regional offices across the United States. I joke with my colleagues that our budget's a rounding error for places like HUD, but they counter with, but you guys have more discretion over your dollars than we do. And I think that's why EDA is really uniquely positioned to play a big role here, and I think we have been playing a big role here, and we can continue to play a bigger role because we have this, I think, extraordinary flexibility in what we're doing. Another point I want to make is because of my local economic development experience, and Assistant Secretary Fernandez was a mayor in Bloomington, Indiana, and so he has a decidedly local economic development experience, that I believe strongly that economic development happens at the local level, you know, bottom up. And so that says to us very clearly that we need to do an extraordinary job at listening and not parachuting in, you know, one size fits all kinds of solutions. It doesn't work. And I've been on the receiving end of that in my past career, where folks from either the federal government or Sacramento came in and tried to tell us how we should do our business, and that never worked. So we are, I think, very good at listening. And the first two speakers actually said a lot of things that are all in our new budget and our new mission plan and our new investment priorities, which is public-private partnerships. Collaboration is critical, and collaboration being so critical now because local governments are all facing dwindling resources, so it's just doesn't make any sense for us to all go at it, you know, separately. We need to combine resources. Multi-jurisdictional approaches, I think, is something we learned in Sacramento when I was the Deputy Secretary of Commerce there. And this notion of innovation clusters. And I just want to make a note on that innovation, that word, tends to scare rural areas. But innovation is about efficiency, and efficiency is about being more competitive. So we're not talking just about biotech and nanotech and all those things. But the other thing I think is really critical about clusters is that this nation has never really had a comprehensive, unified economic development strategy. And that's because we were developed. We didn't need economic development. Economic development applied to places like Bulgaria, right, and Eastern Europe. But innovation clusters, I think, is a way that we can, and I learned all this from Amy and others at Brookings. I'm not taking any credit for this. This is a way that we can really come together and build on a common foundation, not the same foundation, not the same exact strategy, but a common foundation so we can speak on common terms and build our economy together. But the other, I think, interesting and possible transformative idea on clusters is that clusters within the country can be connected to each other. And coming from California, I know that a lot of next generation wind technology is being developed in the Silicon Valley because a lot of them it's computer driven and computer parts. A lot of cars are actually next generation automobiles are being developed in Silicon Valley because it's more computer than it is engine. Are those windmills and those cars going to be built in the Silicon Valley? I don't think so. I think they can be built in places like Michigan and Ohio, and I think that's just one example of, I think, a lot of examples that we need to look at our national economy as a system that is interrelated and can be connected to each other. And so that, you know, that point really leads to this traditional notion of economic development as being zero sum. If I'm the mayor of this town and you're the mayor of the next town, I get the plant, you lose, I win. That's the way my profession operated for a long time, and I worked for a mayor, and I cared about my town, and I was in competition with other cities, and we got into these incentive fights and things like that. That's really foolish, and other countries don't operate that way. They work together. At the ribbon cutting, both mayors should be there cutting the ribbon because it benefits the economy, the regional economy. And so that's a really transformative perspective that we as economic developers, those in the room, we need to go back and hammer that home to our constituents. It's hard to do, but it's important that we keep talking along those lines.
Just one more moment, Brian, please.
Okay, just to wrap up. For Otto communities, the biggest lesson we've learned, and we've worked in Moraine, Ohio, and Fremont, California, and Fenton, Missouri, is that you gotta get in early, and I think that's where EDA's played a good role. I was in Moraine, Ohio with Ed Montgomery, and I think we EDA funded a cluster analysis or a comprehensive economic development strategy. And we got in early, and it's critical to get in early, as all of you know better than I do, that if you don't get in early, the people leave, the infrastructure deteriorates, and then you begin this, how many year cycle of just downward spiral. And so it's important to get a plan earlier. I've heard some of my colleagues say this earlier. You got to have a plan. You got to implement it earlier. And that's where EDA, we feel that's one of our sweet spots.
Thank you, sir. Time is short. I apologize to all the panelists who have so much to say and so much to teach us, but we just have so little time. We can give you just a moment if you have a pithy comment to make to conclude the program. Maybe Congressman, do you have anything?
I just, for 1 second, one of the most important things you can do, I think, is to know the heads of your local companies, to spend time with them, to talk to them, because when you see stuff starting to head south, if they have the confidence in you, they can call you and say, hey, listen, we're really struggling on this or that, without worrying that you're going to go tell a paper. And you can tell them, without worrying about them going to tell the paper or whatever, that you have to build that network up in advance with the unions, with the companies, and with the headquarters as well. And when that happens, good things can happen. A lot of the good things that developed with Chrysler and Delphi was because in Howard County, where Kokomo is, the president of the county council is a Republican. The mayor is a Democrat. I'm one of the congressmen. I'm a Democrat, and Dan Burton is the other, and he's a Republican. But we could get in a room and never worry about the work we're being done being used against us in any way or trying to be used for an angle. It was, how do we move this forward? But the only way we were able to do that was because of the relationships we had before that time. So as much as you can, build those relationships in advance so that you know what's going on in those places, and they have the confidence they can talk to you without them worrying about it being, being in the wash all over town.
Thank you. We have a shade over 10 minutes left, and so perhaps folks in the audience have questions for anybody on the panel or our presenters. Anyone at all? Please, sir.
Yeah.
I think the microphone is coming. Yes, thank you.
My name is William Centeno Lee. I am the chairman and CEO of a new automaker in Connersville, Indiana, called Carbon Motors Corporation. We're going to create 10,000 new jobs over the next 10 years. I think one thing that's a big logic flaw from this morning and partially to this afternoon is that this country has no financial mechanism to accomplish what you're outlining. I don't like playing around the edges. I don't being a lot more strategic is a lot better for us. But last quarter, there were about 700 venture capital firms that invested over $5 billion in life sciences and information technology. There are zero industrial venture capital firms in this country. We don't focus on manufacturing. There's not a bunch of ex-auto executives that got together and said, hey, let's go raise a $2 billion fund and invest in here. So if we want to really restructure this, what we need to start looking at is how do we put up 50 venture capital firms managing about $2 billion each and get serious about technology transfer out of schools, about really funding some of these initiatives, because Governor Granholm, you heard her this morning, right? She's got a bunch of facilities ready to go. We'll go put some seed money into some of these places. Where are you going to get $50, $100, $500 million to put those manufacturing type of initiatives into those facilities? This country does not have the financial infrastructure to do that. And we can keep running around promising all these jobs, but I've spent the last 10 years jockeying back and forth between Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and those folks are too short-sighted to see what you see. So I would like to understand how perhaps the philanthropic organizations can play a role in becoming that strategic industrial venture capitalist that we need in this country.
I don't have a philanthropic answer. I'll leave that to the philanthropists in the room. But I will say we actually need, and we are very supportive of restructuring our financial system and having other forms in that take out sort of the short-term mentality that provides longer-term capital that's so critical for investing in manufacturing. And we have fought very hard to put money into the Clean Technology Manufacturing Fund, another $5 billion, to actually encourage this for people to invest in manufacturing technology. I think these are two sort of fundamental things that government can do that has to do with how our systems work and that money becomes available for long-term investing in the U.S. manufacturing economy.
Any other takers on the question? Brad?
I can say that technology, you mentioned technology transfer, and that's a big focus for Secretary Locke, is how do we get that technology out of the laboratory and into the marketplace much more quickly. And he's convened 50 university presidents from across the United States to start working on that. And EDA, we just launched a national challenge called I-6, which is to challenge six $2 million prizes in six of the EDA regions to challenge teams, consortiums, to come up with a better way to commercialize technology, to get the technology out of the laboratory. And just last comment, maybe this is pithy. Foreign direct investment, and I say this to everybody in the room, is not a bad word. I think for too many years we've shied away from that. International trade and foreign direct investment go together. And just as an example, we're on our way to Hanover, Germany just last month. Got interrupted by the volcano. But we were bringing 16 communities from across the United States, 25 people on very, very short notice to go to the largest green tech show in the world. So we had 2 weeks' notice. We had 16 communities. Half of them were from auto-impacted communities. And the day we were leaving, we had 90 foreign companies, investors included, that wanted to meet with our communities to start working into those places. So that's something we're gonna do again.
Can I ask you a question on that? I mean, I like to see foreign direct investment that actually creates jobs, but so much of it, as we measure it, is foreign direct investment that's just one firm taking over another. It's a change of ownership.
Yeah.
I'm with you on the encouragement of the job creation.
Yeah, these companies were very interested in the big 5 million square foot empty facilities that nobody was in.
That's right.
And so it was jobs. And that's why I think we had such overwhelming response from the auto impacted communities.
We have time for at least one more question. Olivia?
I was wondering if anyone could comment on how the job creation and workforce development conversation that's gone on here will be connected with the land use and physical transformation, specifically, of course, knowing Cleveland a little better than Detroit, the Reimagining Cleveland plan. I was struck at the lunchtime conversation that Detroit seems to be starting to look at those in concert.
Anyone?
Sure. Although, Olivia, as you said, you know Cleveland, so. But you're right, for too long those have been separate conversations, but one of the things in Northeast Ohio we're excited about, in fact, we spent many hours at the bar last night talking about just this issue. So, and if my memory serves me. There is a proposed effort coming out of the Sustainable Communities Initiative, at least in Northeast Ohio. We're excited about using that. Hopefully we'll be competitive and win, but we plan on using that as a way to come together just on those issues. As those of you may know, that is this federal program that is, again, integrated and collaborative and regional. That is getting at social justice, transportation, economic development, and so forth. And so that, to me, is a great example of a role of the federal government who are, in the way you bring us together, you can get some of these unnatural acts to occur, which is getting workforce with environment, with economic development. So I think we have, all of our communities have this exciting opportunity in the coming months, depending upon how we respond to that program.
The guru at that has been Ed Montgomery. I mean, he really has done a remarkable job breaking down those government silos, those federal government silos.
Kevin, room for one more question at least. Please.
My
Sam Burns at the university working Scott on that effort.
At the risk of going to the dark side, I would be interested in one or more of the panelists, depending on how much time. You know, what puts us, or what are the risks as we look to the future? What are the one or two things that we really have to be careful of? I mean, we've created a great vision today and a lot of energy and a lot of great ideas and so on. What is the one or two things that worry you the most when you go to sleep as you think about these things? Anyone? One or two?
I'll tell you real quick, as we're retraining all the displaced auto workers, and that there'll be no jobs after they're retrained.
I worry about we're a nation without a strategy in a world where everyone has one.
I worry about a trade policy where no matter what we do and how competitive we are, that products come in with a completely different set of economic equations behind them, so that in effect these nations are sending their products into us at a 40% off sale. How do you compete with that? We have to have a trade policy that stands up for our country.
I worry about the what Dave Bing called the fundamentals. We're very concerned about all of the things we talked about, but there hasn't been a whole lot said about the fact that this country has gotten so far behind in competitiveness in education, from K-12 through higher education, that we're forgetting about the fundamentals. I mean, all we're talking about are very important, but if we forget about the fundamentals, we're not going to have the basic workforce that's educated to compete in the global economy. We've got to reinvest in education.
So there was a second half to Mayor Bing's comment, because I wrote it down when he said it. He said, stay with the fundamentals, and he said over the long haul. What I worry about is that what we're doing here is strategically simple and tactically extraordinarily difficult. And when the heat comes off, the economy bumps up a little bit, there's going to be a temptation not to stay the course on a lot of this stuff.
I worry about the fact that philanthropy oftentimes has very short frames of attention, and that before the job is done, our attention will be directed elsewhere.
I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
You can tell Sam is a great teacher. He knows how to ask the questions that gets all his students involved. Wonderful. Any more? Well, I'm getting the signal that, unfortunately, our time has expired. So if you'll all join with me in thanking all of our panelists.